Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You might have noticed that on American Variety, we have a fair number of shows dealing with animals in one way or another. Recently, there was one on the business of horse breeding and racing. We've had shows on miniature pot-bellied pigs and bats and birds and bees, not that kind, and many shows on dogs, actually. So, like most people, we like animals, and I guess have a soft spot for people who devote a lot of their time to helping animals in various ways. And we also feature on American Variety, very commonly, people who have an unusual dream and pursue it against all odds and succeed. So my guest today fits both those categories. Her name is Dr. Siobhan Ellison. She's a large animal veterinarian, an animal disease researcher, and a molecular biologist. She has a company located in Central Florida called Pathogenes, which is basically a small biomedical research company that aims to develop patented technologies for the diagnosis and treatment of animal diseases. So that's a pretty broad mission. Looking at your website, Siobhan, at pathogenes.com, it looks like you focus mainly on horses or equine diseases, and within that, much of your work seems to focus on one particular disease called equine protozoal myoencephalitis, I think I said that right, or EPM, which I guess is a type of encephalitis caused by a protozoa or a one-celled parasite. So after that long introduction to who and what you are, welcome, Siobhan.
Thank you.
That's all interesting stuff, and I gather you've made breakthroughs in understanding what causes this horse disease called EPM and how to treat it. But what's even more interesting to me is the journey you've had to make as a woman researcher and owner of a small research company and getting your breakthroughs accepted by the veterinary science establishment and also in getting your patented models and drugs approved by the FDA for their use out in the real world, which is always a big hurdle to get through. So that's the main thing I'd like to talk with you about and hear about your experiences. But first, why don't you give us a quick overview of your work and Pathogenes' work in EPM and what you've discovered?
Okay, Court, thank you. Equine protozoal myoencephalitis is a disease of horses, and horses get that from parasites that are carried by an opossum. And these horses can have many signs of disease, but one of the most recognized is ataxia, or a wobbly gait. And the protozoan parasite that causes this, Sarcocystis neurona, causes inflammation in the nervous tissues of the horse. And inflammation is what gives the horse the clinical signs. And the real mystery of EPM is that the parasite is rarely isolated from the horse. And that's unusual because sarcocystis basically are named for two hosts that they use to complete their life cycle. And the parasites easily recover from these hosts. And I'd like to give you an example. And one is Sarcocystis bovicanus. That infects cows and dogs. And there's Sarcocystis hemisuis, and that affects pigs and people. Sarcocystis are pretty successful parasites, so they're able to infect almost every animal on the planet. So it's been a very long-standing frustration that S. neurona isn't readily found in the infected horse, but what is found is inflammation. And despite that, the prevailing opinion about EPM is based on detecting protozoa in the central nervous system of horses, and that means that the conventional researchers, insist that a spinal tap is needed to diagnose EPM. We have a different opinion, and our model of disease says that parasites cause inflammation, and a spinal tap's not going to detect that. So we explain in our model how parasite exploits an innate or a common inflammatory pathway in animals to cause disease, and it may never even get into the central nervous system. And most recently, we've linked sarcocystis infections to inflammatory disease outside the central nervous system and even developed a serum test that can detect this peripheral disease. So based on experiments, based on the dogma that parasites are in the CNS, conventional parasitologists infected many horses and looked for the parasite in the brain and spinal cord, but they couldn't find them. So with our view of EPM, we developed a model to create disease, and that uses these horse immune cells as a Trojan horse to carry the parasites into the brain. And we demonstrated these parasites, so our model works. And what was really puzzling to us, though, is that these infected horses are the sickest when we kill the parasites. So trying to prevent infections, treating them ahead of time and then challenging them, made these horses even worse. So we made a big step in our research in 2010, and that's when a new sarcocystis gene was discovered. And using this gene, we were able to associate our experimental results and experimental results from the conventional researchers and ours, and we were able to unite those. So that's to say that using genetic code from this gene, we found a potential pathway for inflammation. And with hindsight, we found clues to the published literature, or in the published literature, that supported our views. I don't want to go over the top here, but the inflammatory pathway is IL-6, and that's a cytokine. It's cytokine-mediated, and that's the most logical candidate for causing the signs of disease. I was able to present these concepts to the EPM Society, and that was in the fall of 2014. The outcome of that meeting was the decision to look for sarcosis DNA in the brains of these challenged horses with the very newest and sensitive technology, so I don't think I was really able to convince the establishment of our views. But we were excited to see their coming results, because a negative result is going to favor our view. A positive result would be evidence the parasites did gain entry into the CNS, but don't stay, and that still supports inflammation as the etiology of disease. So we've taken our work a step further, and we've been able to find a drug that blocks this IL-6 pathway. I know it's circumstantial, but if IL-6 mediates this disease, and we can block IL-6 with a chemical and observe a positive change in the signs of disease, then it's very supportive to our view. And that's exactly what we see and where we are today in our research.
Okay, so I bet for you that was pretty much a very basic Cliff Notes description of the science, but I'm gonna restate it in an even more simple way and tell me if I'm totally wrong. And if I'm not totally wrong, just say, sure, that was fine. So
okay.
What I think it sounds like you've discovered is that all along this kind of major disease that causes horses to become spastic and lose their coordination and eventually die, like encephalitis, all along the assumption was that this protozoa, this one-celled animal, caused that disease directly, and that it was probably in the brain and in the central nervous system, in the spinal cord of the brain of the horse, and that's why it had an effect on its gait and ability to coordinate itself. And so veterinary science went on the assumption that that was true, even though they couldn't find any of these protozoa in the brain or spinal cord. But they just figured, well, they took it on faith that it had to be the case. But it sounds like you've discovered that really what's causing that is the inflammation that is in turn caused by these protozoa, and the protozoa may live somewhere else in the body, like the liver or the pancreas or whatever, and that's why they weren't able to find it, and it's kind of a secondary step there that had been missed, and so you've discovered the pathway by which it can be diagnosed, and then I guess from finding this gene and so on, you've discovered ways that it should and shouldn't be treated. Is that more or less accurate?
That's right. See, okay. I did a good job. That is right.
Very good. I hope everybody else out there understood that. But it's a pretty major thing for horse owners and horses and veterinarians, because it gives you, that leads to what are the different products and services that Pathogenes offers? You're not a pharmaceutical company, but do you offer tests for new drugs? Or how do you work, and what kind of services do you offer out in the business world?
Well, Pathogenes is a research company, and we are dedicated to developing tools for the diagnosis of treatment and disease. And the main thing we're offering now is a consultation service, and that's to veterinarians or other companies, big pharma. Veterinarians use our research tests and detecting antibody to specific markers of resneurona, and that's a test that can determine infection. But a byproduct of our work is educating veterinarians about our view of EPM, because it's not out there for them to understand, and it's not being put forward by people that do research or talking about EPM. And we tell them how our view can help them be successful in the field treating horses. We offer several continuing education courses to veterinarians, and there's no interest in the industry to provide a new EPM drug. And because of that, and because there's a need, they're not interested because the market's just too small. So a byproduct of our research is taking what we see as a highly effective treatment through the licensing process.
You know, looking on your website, again, at pathogenes.com, and that's pathogenes.com, but looking there, it looks like you are actually selling some drugs, right? I mean, you're selling something.
No, that's not correct.
Oh, okay.
We're not allowed to sell till we prove certain things to FDA, which is safety and efficacy.
I see.
But we are under the gun to provide potential clinical benefit. So what we do is allow veterinarians can call us, and we consult with them on a specific case. They give us blood, we then consult, we go through the differentials with them, tell them what may and may not work. And a lot of the cases they give us are horses that have been on the conventional therapy and have failed, and they're going to die. So we make the drug in an FDA-approved facility because that's the form we're ultimately going to give to FDA as our product. So for the consulting service, they can treat a horse or partake in our antibody testing. We discuss it with them, and we give them kind of the whole ball of wax. But we're breaking it down to them into pieces. So when they call and say, well, we want to consult, we want to test our horse, and we're going to use some therapy, and we tell them whether that's good or bad or what to expect. And so that will be probably the cost of the part of the work would be that much. We don't make it available to clients, to horse owners. Everything goes through the veterinarian.
Yeah, so it sounds like you're kind of in an intermediate zone where you're more consulting and more trying to get credibility for your findings about this disease accepted in the field. You mentioned that you had gone to a conference and given a presentation, and then the outcome of the conference almost ignored your presentation. So, I mean, in general, what kind of reception are you getting from veterinary researchers and people who kind of are the gatekeepers in these field journals, and also from practicing veterinarians, who are the ones with the feet on the ground who actually do maybe, let's say, the more direct, greater interest in curing their clients' animals? Do you find it increasing? Are you kind of breaking the ice here and making inroads into that, or is it a brick wall? Or tell us about that part of it.
Well, researchers that work on sarcosis syndrome, and these are experts in the field, are still tied to this prevailing opinion of EPM. But it's increasing. The data that they have and the data that they're going to gather is going to lead them more to our view. I think they find it highly frustrating that we can even take some of their cases in which they failed and make them better in 10 days. They don't know how that works, and we're trying to teach them how it works. But you've also got to remember that funding for EPM is through institutions as well as big pharma, and they use these experts in the field, and these experts are then give the opinion of how big pharma's stuff works. So these experts all compete for the same dollars. University researchers can get funding from big pharma, and now we've almost set ourselves up for being in competition with big pharma. For us, then, funding is available through FDA. If a project is designated in such a way, and grants are competitive and lean, but there are opportunities out there, and we fund our research. All of our research is funded through that $45 test and consultation.
So the researchers who are hired by the big pharmaceutical companies, I would say in most cases, probably have a vested interest in finding what the pharmaceutical research company hopes and wants them to find, and they often will do that, I suspect.
I don't necessarily think. I think researchers, they ask a question, but we can all ask questions in which we know the answer. And they put things, maybe put a positive spin on it, and 60% efficacy is well known for the prevailing drug that's out there. But 60% efficacy is licensed for improving one grade. Well, that means you can take a horse that's next to falling down, and so now it's just leaning on a wall. That's one grade. That's success. Our level of success, we say, back to use. That's where we want a horse to be. So I think researchers do an excellent job of providing what the data is, but it can be in places you can't find it. I think the more to the point is that when big pharmacies are the ones doing the funding, and they fund a university, and the university puts that data out there, they have already pierced the veil of scientific altruism, and that's where we can come under that scrutiny. We fund our own research, so are we only funding what's beneficial to us? So I think it's a very hard thing to parse, but what is not really recognized is that when a university person does some research for a company and they find something and they patent it, the university, that's their business model now, is patent that IP and license it back to the big pharma. So now every sale of a drug goes back into the research coffers to refund it. And these researchers are on the patents. Their names are on the patents, too, so they get royalties for that. So when science took a turn maybe in the 90s, I was in it in the 70s and left to go do vet stuff and came back to it now, And science back then was all sharing and cooperation and about sharing the data and the information, and that's why we're scientists. But what it is now is it's business, and universities have now commercialized science. And the ideas that are financially viable are the things that are going to persist. And that's one reason why our particular information won't persist unless somebody small takes the energy to do it. It can't happen. It's not a $20 million or above annual revenue, and so Big Pharma won't do it. So, you know, I could get my stuff out there if I hire one of these talking heads to go and present it and pay them, but I shouldn't have to do that. I should be able to prove the data. I should be able to prove the merits of the science by itself, and that's what we're doing.
Interesting. It's a very similar thing in every field, really. You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Dr. Siobhan Ellison, a veterinary researcher located in Central Florida. She runs a company she started called Pathogenes, which, among other things, has found the disease model and the route for infection of a disease that affects horses. And it kind of runs up against the established wisdom in the field, so she's kind of an upstart startup who's trying to get her idea and her model accepted more. Backing up a bit, Siobhan, what led you into this field? How'd you start out?
Well, after practicing equine medicine, and I was specializing in horses, I went back to the University of Florida, and I got a PhD in molecular biology. And my project resulted in a candidate molecule, and that would allow us to diagnose sarcocystis neurona infections. The university, of course, patented the technology, and that's the business model. That's the point, is to patent and then license the intellectual property. And because it was not going to be it wasn't much of a university or an industry interest, that's why I started my company in 1999, so that I could continue to do the research on this and develop it into a diagnostic test. There's a tremendous need for an animal model in the EPM industry. That was where the need was, not a diagnostic test. So I contracted work to develop this Trojan horse model. And I used this model in studies for all the companies that developed EPM drugs and vaccines. So the development of the model has positioned us as an out-of-the-box thinker. So we got contracts for projects, and our projects aren't limited to EPM. We did a non-porcine, non-monkey cell culture for PRRS, a pig disease, culture methods for avian coccidia, which led to worldwide patents, culture methods for Lawsonia and Nosema, which is a bee disease, and Cryptosporidia. We even developed an autologous vaccine for the University of Florida because they were having trouble with their baby pigs. And, of course, we didn't get any money or recognition for helping the piglets, but solving the problem is good enough for us. But one of the downsides of this contract research is that our work resulted in data, and that's been confidential for 10 years. So our work could be repeated by others for the same companies, and they'd come in and look at our data and compare it with their data, and they could publish this. Mm. So I think they were smarter about contracts or understood them better than I did, or there are definitely different rules that govern universities. But we're funding now. We're big enough to fund our own research for our own tests, and it's that funding of research on this sea otter sarcocystis gene that allowed us the ability to understand EPM on a different level. And again, the self-funding presents a conflict of interest, and that prevents some of our ideas from being published because people see that as a conflict of interest. But what separates us from the rest of the industry is our understanding of EPM. And it doesn't matter if the veterinary researcher is skeptical about our ideas. We've now trained and consult for 2,000 practicing veterinarians in this country, Canada, and South America.
It must have been tough just getting off the ground, I mean, trying to ramp up to do lab work as a small business startup in a biomedical field, because it's not something you can do on $100. You need funding, and a lot of people go to venture capitalists for funding, but they kind of own you then, and it sounds like you didn't. You just kind of bootstrapped yourself up a piece at a time. Was that really hard to do? I mean, just kind of in a nutshell, was it extremely tough to do, or did you get lucky and it was not as hard as you thought it might be?
Not really that hard, I guess, but it's difficult to promote your ideas, But if you go to a company like I did Bayer, gave them a cold call on Christmas, and I said, I have this wonderful gene. I can do a diagnostic test. If you can diagnose disease, you'll know which ones to treat. And they said, yeah, not so interested. But what they were interested in is model. And they said, can you develop us a model? And I said, sure, sure. So I said, if I develop the model, I'm getting smarter at this point. I said, if I develop the model, I get the patent on it, but you prosecute it because patents are expensive to prosecute. And they said, sure, we'll do that. And so they funded us a couple of years. And then we rolled back into Shearing Plough needed our model to do something and some of the others. So funding it that way allowed us to, and when we learned something and we couldn't publish and a veterinarian or a horse owner might call and ask us about our stuff, we'd say, this is what we know. This is the direction you should go in. And so it evolved from that. We used to run, you know, just a few sprinkling of tests here and there, and now we run a significant number. I'd be surprised if we didn't run 60% of the sera in the country. I'd be really surprised if we didn't.
Well, you mentioned earlier in the show about dealing with FDA, and I guess you are trying to get approval for some drug or drugs. At what point did you start to deal with the FDA and I guess the Food and Drug Administration, right? So very briefly then, what are the necessary steps to getting a drug or protocol approved for use in the field, just as briefly as you can do it?
When we realized we were able to alleviate disease, we called FDA. And FDA has a program called MUMS, Minimum Use in a Major Species. And any sponsor can receive this designation if they meet certain criteria, which is that you have something that is beneficial to the public, but Big Pharma won't do it because it constitutes a small revenue, less than $20 million. So our drugs are designated under MUM.
Mm-hmm.
We have to show the same thing, safety and effectiveness. And we've spent the last few years submitting things to FDA and starting to meet those hurdles.
So with that program, which is geared to smaller businesses, I guess that's an avenue that's easier to take. But even within that, what kind of reception did you get as a kind of an almost a one-woman band? Was it hard to break through, or did you get a pretty open reception to start off with? What was that like?
They don't give you tea and crumpets, but they certainly give you the same thing that's available to everyone else. And that's to give you GFIs, guidance for industries. And these are detailed documents for every step of every situation. So while Big Pharma may have the advantages that a limitless amount of money brings, and it's certainly hard to overlook a large group of lawyers in the lobby, we get a regulatory team. We get a team of people that are dedicated to helping you take this through.
What about, is it important to get approval from big names in the field, other people who are put on panels to review your proposal?
No. No.
Okay.
No. The veterinarians that are on your team then they have animals, and they're people that take great pride in what FDA does, and that's assuring a safe and effective product. So they have everything they say back to you is in writing, and that becomes basically a law. So they have to be careful. They have to be unified. They have to have consensus opinion. So it's up to you as a sponsor to present something they can agree with, and they will. And they kind of direct you a little bit, but they can't tell you exactly what to do. But I think they try and help you in that, but by the same token, they're not going to let you slide, and they absolutely want things in the literature. They want a consensus of the literature to support their view. They can't just agree with you, even though you think it's as plain as the nose on your face. They can't say, well, that makes sense to us, because that becomes law. They have to say, well, show us in the literature, prove us with the science. And that's why it's so important for us to turn the tide of opinion on what EPM is. And once we have that, and once the literature supports that, FDA will be more receptive to some of the things that we want to do.
As part of the process of turning the tide of opinion, do you have to run studies, or are the consultations and the results that veterinarians are getting based on what you're telling them, are those part and parcel considered to be results, or do you have to run more formal studies that are hard to set up and afford?
We have laboratory studies, and those laboratory studies are safety studies where we have to overdose the animals and prove the animals don't have any lesions based on the drug. That's a lab study. And we have a component effectiveness. We have to prove each component in our drug is necessary, and that's a difficult study. That's 80 horses. You're talking about a $1 million study for that. And the second part of it is FDA said, well, it can work in the lab, but what about the field where people give other things or different situations? So that's where you have field effectiveness studies. And that's what we're gathering now is potential clinical benefit, reasonable expectation that it'll work, because we give it to these veterinarians, and these veterinarians give it to horses, and they call back and say, this horse improved, they're riding them or doing whatever. So we take that data, and that's potential benefit, and submit that to FDA. And then there'll be a more formal study they require, and it is a field study, but they're going to require us to give a placebo. And you have somebody that's contemplating losing their animal in the next couple of weeks, they're not so receptive to a placebo study, and that's a milestone we have to overcome.
Yeah, so it's not like you're working with lab mice in the lab. It's a whole different thing with multi-thousand-dollar animals, so that's a tricky...
Multi-thousand-dollar animals, Court. These are animals people love.
That's right,
they,
too.
They
you
say
know,
this
sure.
is a horse of a lifetime, and
sure.
we treat as many backyard cheap horses that people love.
And that's what
we find most rewarding about this is that the clients call and the horse owners, and they're the ones that express the gratitude to us. And some of these owners are veterinarians themselves, and they tell us how their horse has done. They send us pictures. They send us videos. And those are what give you the good feelings that, yes, let's persevere. We saved 10 horses this week. We made a difference to 10 lives. So we can proceed, and that resolves us to fight all the fronts we have, which is prevailing opinion and the tediousness of FDA. It's tedious to us, but obviously it's absolutely necessary to them.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, but, you know, you mentioned giving horses placebos and then watching them die, and the owner is hoping they didn't get the placebo. So that's, you know, it's obviously much more difficult than dealing with mice. But
yeah, well, Court, we spent a couple of years with CVM to design experiments so that the placebo animals will not suffer, that we have a method in place to rescue them. So I don't believe we'll compromise any animal's health in our placebo-controlled studies.
Oh, okay, well, that's good to know. I tell you, Siobhan, we've just got a minute or so left, but real quickly, if you can tell us, what's been the most kind of surprising part of this adventure? Or maybe you could tell us what's been the most gratifying part of it, other than what you just said, which is curing horses. Obviously, that's a big thing, but is there some specific thing that's really stood out in your mind as being something surprising that was great?
The most surprising is the bonfire of vanities that EPM seems to stir in the EPM community.
Okay.
That it wasn't openly receptive that here's a new idea, let's explore it. It's been a 15-year struggle that you're wrong, and it's taken us a long slog to kind of turn the tide.
Yeah, you've challenged the conventional wisdom, and with that a lot of people's egos, so I can see that. But what do you see as the next step then? We've got, you know, 30 seconds left. What do you see as the next big challenge for pathogens beyond EPM?
Beyond EPM, I guess publishing our data and certainly some of the other projects we mentioned earlier need some input. If I were going to start a new project, I'd probably work on Nosema. I think the bees need our help. The bee industry could use the molecular tools, and certainly the bee industry needs more funding.
I agree with that. We've had shows on that. So to learn more, again, go to Pathogenes' website at pathogenes.com, PathogenesCom. Siobhan Ellison, I want to thank you so much for being on with us on American Variety. It's been really interesting.
Thank you, Cord. I appreciate having the opportunity to explain some of the things about our work.
And thanks to all of you out there for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.